Thank you very much, Anne. So sorry for one slightly convoluted title. It's quite difficult to squeeze it into the title space based on the template, but then, of course, having once committed 3 or 4 months ago to talking on this subject, I thought I'd better try and keep the same title. And currently working with Dana and colleagues on the London Transport Environment project, based in Oxford, working with them. And so this project, this paper and the work that's been done, it has been inspired and then as part of the LBSE project, but it does go back to some previous work we've done. So for those of you who saw my presentation at Calo 9, you'll recognise some slides, so you can probably go to sleep for the first 3 or 4 minutes. So what I'm going to do is just briefly talk about why we're interested in using theory in e-learning and hence pedagogy planning tools. Have a quick look at what we've done before, talk a little bit about how we're using theory within the LBSE project, and then focusing on the work I've done recently, which was 10 interviews with teaching practitioners, to try and work out what it is they think about theory and reflection on their practice, to try and see how this might be supported within the LBSE itself, and then conclude with some tentative implications for the design of the tool. The first thing to think about is, well, why do we want to use theory in the first place? And the first thing is that it gives us a frame, it takes us beyond where we are. Shirley Laws was contrasting theory with reflective practice and said that sound theoretical knowledge implies generalizability and gives a framework of understanding that ultimately can improve the quality of practice and lead to the transformation of your personal experience. And she contrasts this with reflective practice, which she feels gives you an individualistic response to problems by basing purely on your experience. You risk staying at the level of your existing competence, whereas theory can take you beyond that. In terms of why it's important for e-learning to ensure good pedagogic design, Martin Oliver, in an editorial in Alt-J 2006, talked about the need to understand relationships between technology and learning, what teachers do and why they do it, and then working out how technology can support that. Another reason is to ensure that it's teaching and learning that drives the use of digital technology, not vice versa, this idea of technological determinism. So the argument is that theory can provide that glue between practice and technology, so we can make sense of individual practice and then generalise from it, find appropriate solutions to particular pedagogic problems or dilemmas. And then the thing about theory, the word theory itself actually is incredibly complex, and we've found through reading and listening to people what they think about theory, that it covers a multitude of things. It's almost like a meta-taxonomy of what they mean by theory. And over the past few years, sort of reading my PhD and then since, I sort of landed on 4 useful categories that other people have come up and presented. The idea of a pure theory, pure and simple, as a way for understanding and predicting some situation and the explanatory power that it can possess. I think Mays Integrators have also referred to them as empirically based accounts of the variables that can influence the learning process and explanations of the way that influence occurs. So the idea of a theory has something explanatory about it. And then you can contrast these with the idea of a model, an abstract representation that helps us to understand something. I suppose we could think of things like Kolb's learning cycle and Gilly Salmon's 5-step, a model for online discussion would be perhaps a model. I mean, the barriers, the borderlines are very, very blurry, but the thing is, I think it's actually terribly important, and I hope I'll make clear later on that these distinctions do matter. And then you have the idea of a framework, which gives you some sort of structure and vocabulary for exploring concepts and making decisions. And I probably put under this sort of heading things like Diana's conversational framework, things like cognitive apprenticeship and activity theory, which even though it's called a theory, to me it's an analytical framework. And the final thing is a taxonomy, an orderly classification, such as Bloom's taxonomy of learning outcomes. But all of these seem to have acquired the term theory. So I'm going to be terribly careful. Sometimes when I mean theory, I do mean theory in that top line. But theory with a small t is a shorthand for all of these. Really what we could think about is anything that's one of these that has been described in the peer reviewed literature and is commonly accepted within research and practitioner communities as relevant and useful, even valid. It's all very, if I sort of put it into words, I feel, gosh, no, this isn't right, and someone's going to say, no, but what about? So it is very, very tricky, but try and keep it all in control. What I'll do very quickly is to run through some of our previous work and show you how we implemented two theory in two different ways in the pedagogy planner tools that were developed under the GIST Design for Learning programme. Many of you will be familiar with them already. And the first one is the London Pedagogy Planner, which Dana and her colleagues developed. The key feature of this tool is that it used her conversational framework to distill theories and principles of learning into design decisions and parameters, and to take the user through a series of design decisions. I don't know how clear that is, but on this screen, the teacher is assigning hours to different sorts of teaching methods, and the conversational theory is used here to allocate them to different kinds of learning, so it'll help the teacher see the spread of different types of learning. So this is supporting the decision making. Phoebe was a lot less clever. Oh, and it also gave me some help as well. Phoebe was a lot less clever. It basically consisted of one side you would do some form filling to create your learning design, but it had context sensitive help. So when you run the teaching approach, you would click to the other side of the screen and get an introduction to, in this case, it was some constructivism. So what we gave users were descriptive outlines of models of teaching and learning that maybe derived formal theories but were mapped more readily to actual teaching intentions and thus to learning designs. We did also supply some generic sequences. So that's a very sort of contrasting, simple approach. Both of these tools were evaluated, and we actually had a joint review meeting with the Great and the Good in Birmingham. And I just picked out some of the sort of key findings that people said about theory and e-learning in relation to these two tools. Yes, they agreed that theory could be a cornerstone of professional practice. Academic staff need to have an understanding of the underpinnings of the profession and an antidote to technological determinism. But there was a lot of contention regarding the extent to which teachers consciously espouse formal theories, a specific formalised theories, and the extent to which they are driven by private intuitive theories based on their cumulative experience. Somebody felt that empirical evidence suggests that teachers are driven more by prior experience and work on an experiential basis rather than the specific pedagogical theories. This is not really helping tremendously. And so a sort of suggested way forward from the sound pass was came from somebody else who felt that we should combine a knowledge of theory with skills to make learning design decisions, which I think is probably more what the Learned and Pedagogy Planner was doing, certainly far more than Phoebe. It is more important they have an understanding of the theory and are able to evaluate resources or select appropriate tools. So that's where we left off at the end of those last two projects. And then moving into the learning design support environment in which Phoebe and the Pedagogy Plan came together with three or four other institutions as well, so it's been quite a big collective effort. This is a multi-institutional project. It's funded by the ESRC, EPSRC, under their technology Teaching and Learning Research Programme, Technology and Arts and Learning, Phase 2. And what we're trying to do is to assemble sort of learning design support environments to support university lecturers in developing effective technology-enhanced learning. So as probably realised from earlier presentations from yesterday, we're trying to develop a number of online tools and trial and experiment with existing ones as well. And we want to use theory to support the design process and take teachers beyond their current practice, the heart of the original comment about theory, to leave room for individual creativity. So the tools that we want to build will make use of what we call appropriate theories, models, frameworks, and taxonomies that best meet users' expectations, cover the range of decisions that lecturers need to make, and that we feel comfortable about embedding in the system from a technological point of view. And we're also thinking about generating learning designs for each of the different models of learning, so people can do some what-if modelling. If I want to do a constructive learning experience, what would it look like? If I want to do some inquiry-based learning experience, what would that look like? So this is the really, really ambitious part. We're actually combining theories of knowledge and learning and our knowledge from previous research to create an ontology of learning design, which consists basically of the concepts and entities within the domain of learning design and their relationships, and puts together with educational theories. And the idea is that there'll be sort of an inference engine that uses this ontology to interpret users' actions and provides appropriate support and guidance. It's very sophisticated, much more sophisticated than we've done before. And I find it fascinates me. It's terribly complicated. And this is just a little bit of it to show you how amazingly complex it is. And you probably can't read it, but there are some theories. This is the ontology, and there are some theories somewhere in the middle right-hand side. And that is as much as I'm going to say about it. Because, in fact, the researcher who's been developing this is giving a talk at the AI and Ed conference. I'm not quite sure it's actually at this very moment, but sometime today or yesterday on the subject. And she was here. I'm sure she'll be able to talk much more intelligently about it. So leave it as there for the time being. So that's just a good impression. Now, the ontology was already being developed before I did the interviews I'm going to talk about now. So the interviews were really partly to verify that the theories we're proposing to include are appropriate for purpose and validate those previous findings that we could have come out of the Phoebean and LPP reviews to explore them in a slightly more systematic way. So what we were interested in really was what's the value of using theories in learning design? What theories, models, frameworks and taxonomies are lecturers aware of? Which do they consider relevant to higher education, which is a sector we're working in, and which ones do they actually use themselves? And then bearing in mind that there's a sort of slight staff development function in the LBSE, we want to see how theory is handled and introduced in staff development programmes for early career lecturers as well as more experienced members of staff. And finally, going back to this idea of reflective practice, is there a relationship between using theory and reflective practice, and how to help you go about that? So we've recruited what we call informant practitioners, who are, at the moment we've got 10 of them. They're very experienced lecturers, and the reason we've chosen experienced people is that they can perceive the vision that lies beyond the rough and ready prototype interface or as a quickly described spec. And they can also consider that vision and the requirements for its realisation from the perspective of somebody who's less experienced in teaching. If they've been through all that themselves, hopefully they can remember. We've chosen because they can remember. So we have, that's their roles, we have 10 of them. 7 of them come from Russell Group universities, 3 from post-92 universities. Quite a sort of broad profile. We have 7, as you can see, who are actually active teach undergraduates. We have some who specialise in technology-enhanced learning and staff development, including staff development and e-learning. And we have one person who we've worked with across institutional bodies, one of the subject centres, so who gives us working across within a subject but across different organisations. We have these specific questions, but I customised the questions to each person. And as well as the questions asked in the interview, which covered the whole range of the actual interviewers, covered the whole range of learning design practice, not just theory, I also gave them a quick tick box exercise so you could get some sort of rather quick and dirty quantitative data. And then, having had all the interviews transcribed, they were just quickly analysed in reference to the research questions, but keeping an eye open to things that might emerge. This is the first of my real minefield slides. It's changed so many times because I've lost my animation on this one. This is meant to be progressively point by point. For some people, the theories are part of their worldview. It's sort of part of them. They're more cuts and structures than what I do, and partly an unreconstructed Piagetian. It's a constant. It just happens instinctively. So it's there, mushing around in the back of their minds. It inspires what they do. But they might not necessarily explicitly apply a theory sort of overtly to a particular design. It sort of informs their general thinking, but they won't say, right, I do this, and this. In fact, someone wrote, I don't think I've ever read a theory and then said, okay, this is how I'll implement it. Others use things like frameworks for structuring students' learning. This lecturer, almost everything she does, she maps to the conversational framework, which is And his plans are fantastic for working out where, misidentifying where students are within their learning. So those two are to do with the worldview and how you think about design or how you go about doing design. The other two are about looking back and what you've done. I'm trying to change, and Clear is quite useful to show that I've like, demonstrating I've actually managed to change. And the last person who's disappearing off the bottom feels that the only value that main value of Clear is to check what he's done. He was actually very articulate about the function of Clear. He felt that explanatory theories are about more about critiquing. He said, he's drawn an analogy made by given by a talk he's heard by Dylan William at the Institute of Education. So if you build a bridge, you don't start from Newton's theory of gravity. It's not going to help. But if you don't know Newton's theories of gravity, you're not going to be able to build a bridge, and you won't know why it fell down. So we're getting a sense that theory has a role here to play in reflection. So although there is a certain amount of people are aware of theory, but what does seem to be very strong is that it's not just the theory, it's the pragmatic considerations, what you've got to do with your students. What I want to get out of the session, learning outcomes, the sort of things you want the students to do and yourself to do, so the activities. Key things here, time, number of students, distance. This was from somebody who actually runs an online course who's got people sort of has synchronous chats with people in New York and Singapore, saying it's so he has to bear all these pragmatic considerations in mind. Somebody else will drive her teaching by motivating how she can motivate the students. Somebody else starts from assessment. So three of these people, the first, third, and fourth, actually were quite talkative about the theory. The second one doesn't like theory very much. He says, I'm a sociologist, I don't know the educational stuff. I need for somebody else to tell me things are going wrong and explaining the theory from that side. But there's some sort of dialogue, some sort of balance, some sort of tension between theories that guide them or they have inspired themselves by and what they have to do with the students in the actual class. This is the findings from the little tick box exercise. We'd come up, I think, in sort of a couple of brainstorms of some likely candidate theories and frameworks. And I took these to the student, the lecturers, and asked them three questions. I heard of it, development of HE, and did actually use it. And some people weren't always sure whether they'd actually heard a particular theory, so I left them out. So we have quite a variety. Not many people seem to have heard collaboration theory or the advance organiser. More as everybody's heard of social constructivism. I don't think anybody dared say they didn't have that conversational framework. But what's interesting there is an awareness. There's a sense of whether or not they're relevant within HE, and then whether they actually use them. I mean, things like the low usage of, say, Salmon's five-step model is probably purely because most of the people I'm talking to are doing face-to-face teaching and learning, so that it would be relevant to them. And the fact that people weren't sure about their knowledge, whether they used them or not, was an indication that people seem very often to come to theory from a result of practice. They may have done things in a certain way for years and years and years without knowing it had a name and a string of references attached to it. Someone said, well, suddenly you're then presented with models of student learning and you look at the stuff and go, oh, that's what I do. And in fact, the same person I asked her about spiral curriculum, she wasn't sure what it was, and she said, oh, well, I've been doing that. So it was an absolute, blessed me with a perfect example. So we took the ones that they, in this, our list, that they used. We also said, what have we left out? And some of them told us. And this is a wordle of the combination of the theories and frameworks, etc., that they said they'd used, and the ones that they added. I think the key things that we've actually missed out from our list were communities of practice and a couple of student-focused models on learning styles and deep and surface learning. And tucked in pale purple, very, very embarrassed sort of way, is behaviourism. Mm-hmm. And behaviourism is terribly old-fashioned, isn't it? Well, I actually had this conversation with somebody I always thought is really clued up on theory and really clued up on modern ways of teaching. And he said to me, there was this big debate in the 1990s about constructivism versus behaviourism. There's a sense that constructivism was riding this big wave. And while I do think there are useful things in it, having had children and having watched teachers work a lot, it does strike me that there are some sort of conditionings you can use very, very effectively in order to get people to do certain things, whether they like it or not, because you know it's going to be critical and that sort of thing. I don't think I necessarily, and one will necessarily chuck out a theory that I know kind of works because of some sort of political agenda. So, as we are aware, there's a lot of sort of fashion and fad in theory. And this could be quite a challenge for us in the LDSE. Do we only include the things that people are using at the moment? Or would you think, well, okay, behaviour is a bit old hat, but it does have its uses, and I certainly doubt that in the case of watching my children learn in times tables. There's lots to be said for the practice of behaviourism, it just gets them in. I think in terms of thinking about the theories that we would actually need to support, we mustn't be afraid of putting in some unfashionable ones here, because they might give people that odd light bulb moment, you never know. Sort of a couple of other themes emerge from in respect to the ones they use. People very rarely use one or one at a time. It's not so simple as saying I'm constructivist or social constructivist or this. It's far more complex. And here somebody's talking about using four or five things interchangeably. And something is slightly worrying that somebody else pointed out, this is idea of sloppiness. People are not referencing properly. Not only that, but they're misusing the names of theories. Using deepened surface learning, to me, harder wheel learning, rather than the making connections that she understands by it. And I don't know anybody else who knows this about communities of practice. You can't have communities anymore. You have the communities of practice, whether or not they're to do with emphasis with Bengal or not. So there is a sort of area where people are actually misusing theory. I think the hardest thing I've had to get to grips with, and it's something that actually popped up in discussions within our project team, is this difference between theories of teaching and theories of learning. And I've used to piece together some thoughts from an interview with one of our more experienced practitioners. And pedagogic theories being the sort of things that you use to construct a learning experience. So something like, I suppose, inquiry-based learning, the five-step model, they help you make decisions. Whereas the theories of learning are explanations of how people come to know, how the way to explain how, as far as one can, how students learn. But they can form the basis for these pedagogic theories. So I think in a way it's probably wrong to call pedagogic theories. They're probably more like the frameworks and approaches. And so here's a sort of classic quote, the place for learning theory is forever the basis for a critique of what I'm seeing rather than for actually designing. So the fact that somebody has on a previous screen, some people say, oh yes, it guides my design, and some say, no, it doesn't. I think it's something to do with this distinction between pedagogic theories, theories of learning, what's the framework, how can we make decisions, what's an explanatory theory that explains why things have gone wrong. And this will come out a bit more, I think, possibly about some reflection. And in fact, the gentleman from which this quote originated had actually, with the colleagues, he'd formulated a particular model for teaching adult learning. And he said, well, it's based on theory and practice, but I think it's really a pedagogic principle rather than a learning one. So it's very difficult trying to piece together and make inferences from what people have said, and it's something we'd like to go back and perhaps quote more. Unfortunately, I don't have much time to interview this person, so we haven't really been doing that much depth. In terms of theory and staff development programmes, and we talked earlier about people coming to theory through practice, and this is very much the recommendation of the people who are in staff development and lecturers who've undergone staff development programmes. What teachers need, it's work-based learning for them. They need to go out and do their job, so you give them the tools, and the theory can come on later. And I had two very good examples of how the staff development officers structure their lecturers' learning around specific models. The first one was she has had this very ambitious online discussion as part of a face-to-face course. And she structured the whole thing according to Jilly Salmon's five-step model. But she didn't introduce the five-step model until they are well into into that particular part of the course. So they had been experiencing this model before they learned what it was. And the second one was somebody who is introducing Web 2.0 tools in the College of Arts and Law to Universities and Humanities. And he's using a community practice model. He's putting them together and saying, right, somebody's the master, who's slightly more ahead of the others. But there's a good apprentice. This is a community practice model. He's actually very upfront about it. And although he wasn't fully intending it to be that the teachers to take the COP on board with their students, he said a lot of them actually had. And when they do come to teach theory explicitly, keep it accessible, focus on key concepts, let them go off and do extra reading. After all, their lecturers, their researchers, they should be able to go off and read about theories and get to know about it. Finally, moving on to the idea of theory and reflection, lovely quote here, it exactly mirrors what Laws was saying at the top. What we want to do is to get people out of themselves and have their assumptions challenged using the tool. Reflection is very much a dialogic process with oneself or with others. I never say this is what I think, and there's any evidence of that. It does involve more than it worked on Tuesday. You need to be able to head into the theory behind it to work out why it's not working. If it's broken, go and have a look at the theory, and that might tell you why, or possibly other things that it's practiced. And as someone pointed out, we think really that the main purpose of theories of learning is to guide reflection. So, what does this all mean for our project? I've rewritten this slide about 3 or 4 times in the last 24 hours, and I still don't think I've got it right. It's very, very complicated. If our informants are typical, then most teaching staff, in fact, 9 out of 10, voluntarily engage with theory / models / frameworks / taxonomies / actually research findings that are actually giving rise to emergent models, like the 7 principles assessment from and Nicol. So yes, they want this stuff, and they can actually give me a huge sort of eclectic range of models and research that we can actually think about incorporating into our tool. What we really need to tease out more is this distinction between pedagogic theories, what I talk about teaching approaches or approaches to supporting students' learning, the frameworks that help you to design, make decisions, help you build a learning design, and then these other theories that are more explanatory, that support reflection, that might be sitting in the background, sort of be people general inspiration. And be absolutely clear what we mean, because the important thing to do is to get the right have the right kind of theory for the right task. Otherwise, we could alienate people who are slightly put off by theory already. Keep the theories tacit under wraps, where users don't actually need to know them, or indeed they'd be alienated by them, and have a sort of policy of progressive disproposal, almost like a spiral curriculum in introducing theories to lecturers. I think finally, thinking about the staff development side, is if this, the LDSE would be something that people feel has a staff development function, to see how it might fit into the pedagogic approaches. And we recently run a workshop where people seem to be very positive about the idea of using the tool. And then there's the final thing, is that there is some sort of, despite the fact that we might be pedagogically neutral, there will be something built into the interactions in the LDSE that smacks of some assumption or approach about how teachers learn. And that to be in there, we may not realise it's there, but it's there, and I think we've got to be aware of it. And that's going to be quite, So I'm going to stop there. And we do have a project website, ldse.org.uk. Before we have to have the SLC logo and the grant reference on our application, so I've ticked the final box.